Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I am Rick, he's Dan, and Dan, this is the 43rd edition of the podcast.
You know, I think given the tenor of the discussion we're about to have, it's probably fitting that we had such trouble finding a 43, but today's podcast is really about the light at the end of the tunnel. And so while I was perusing some of the baseball almanac, I discovered that Joe Nuxall actually wore 43 when he made his debut with the Reds in 1944 during World War II at the age of 15, before switching over to his more well-remembered, I think it was 38 or 39 when he came back to the Reds in the 50s, once he was old enough to actually be playing in the major leagues. So that's a little obscure, Rick, but that's kind of good. I mean, Joe Nuxall is a Cincinnati icon, so.
Yeah, I'll take it. That works. That works for me.
All right. So since last we spoke, well.
Not good.
Well, here's the thing. You know, anytime things happen, you would consider me somewhat of a, someone who has some highbrow, what's the word I'm looking for, pretensions, wouldn't you, Rick?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, absolutely. So I always think, you know, what can we learn from the classics? What do the classics teach us? And I remember this. This is the opening to Dante's Inferno. Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. And that's about the best way I can describe what's happened to the Xavier basketball team over the last 2 weeks. On Saturday, the 25th of January, they lost 81-72 at Providence. Had a full week to prepare for a home game against Seton Hall that I think most people viewed as a bit of a layup. And the Muskies really laid an egg on Saturday afternoon, February the 1st, losing to Seton Hall 68-60. They then made the quick turnaround to snowy Philadelphia to play the number 6 Villanova Wildcats, and that went about as well as you would expect, with the Musketeers getting completely plowed under in the second half and losing 81-58. Right now, nothing really working for this team over the last three games, and we'll unpack that in excruciating and painful detail. I know some folks out there, you know, we try on this show to be fair and balanced. I think, we do not withhold praise, but sometimes we have to criticize. So if you're the type that cannot bear discussions of some of the negative things that have happened over the last 2 weeks, you may want to skip this week. But Rick, let's start with the Providence game. Well, first of all, let's start by sort of taking stock. The Muskies now 15-7, 5-4 in the A-10, sitting fourth in the league in league play. Next in action on Saturday, playing Providence again. They'll then travel to Hinkle Fieldhouse on Tuesday the 11th to play Butler. Rick, let's start with the Providence game. The story of this one, I think, was that Xavier just could not control Bryce Cotton or LaDante Henton. So let's start with Cotton. What was he doing? What were the challenges that he presented? How did he sort of exploit Xavier's backcourt in that game?
He was great. He plays a really fun brand of basketball to watch, and I think this was the first time that we've actually seen D. Davis beat regularly off the dribble in a game. This is a bad matchup for D because he doesn't have elite quickness. And, you know, Mac made the reference that Bryce Cotton was almost like a college Allen Iverson because of his quickness with the ball. I mean, he is just a blur. Plus he knocked down 3 for 8 from three, dished out 7 assists. He was able to get into the lane and create a lot of problems for this team. And as we go along, we'll talk about that happening at some other positions, but this was a time where it was just D. Davis getting beat off the dribble. And when that happens, Xavier's defense is not going to be in a good spot because he's by far their best on-ball defender. They're not very quick to recover defensively, and we saw that in this game. I mean, Bryce Cotton was able to really exploit their lack of speed to recover on kickouts. And then LaDante Henton just went to work. He can shoot it from three, but he's relentless on the glass. And, you know, he got a lot of stick backs. I know he had 6 of his 11 rebounds were offensive in that game. So he's just a guy that keeps working. And I didn't think Xavier did a terrible job of guarding him necessarily, but he's so relentless that, I mean, if you take a play off or if he's going to get his points, but if you give him any room at all, just an inch, he's going to take it and end up with a 20-point game, which is exactly what he did. He had 23.
You know, this is a game where X got off to a slow start. This has been kind of a problem for them in recent days. And in fact, it really has been an issue for them throughout the Big East season. The Musketeers really trailed the entire way in this game. You know, it went back and forth at the beginning of the game, but once Providence went up at the 13-12 mark, that was a lead I don't believe they ever relinquished. The Muskies were only down 35-31 at halftime, but immediately an issue that has cropped up time and time for this team reared its ugly head, which is that they absolutely could not get stops out of halftime. They went through two or three lengthy periods in this game where Providence scored literally on every possession for 3 or 4 minutes at a throw. And it's become a major issue for this team. If you look at the defensive efficiency ratings for the Musketeers, they have gotten progressively worse since the Georgetown game. It has gotten worse each game. Providence, Seton Hall, Villanova. Meanwhile, they're giving up more points per possession, a greater number in each one of those games. Meanwhile, they're scoring less points of possession in each one of those games. So what we've really seen is an erosion on both ends of the ball. Looking at what X was doing offensively in this game, Rick, Justin Martin was effective offensively, but he really was the only one. Everyone else seemed to have a real struggle, and that includes even Samaje Kristen, who was relatively efficient, but maybe didn't take the game by the scruff of the neck that you would like, and certainly missed a ton of opportunities, especially in the second half of this game.
Yeah, I thought, you know, Stainbrook's line didn't look terrible when you look at it. He said 11 points, 9 boards. But, you know, he had 3 turnovers, and I think there was another probably possession that could have been deemed a turnover or a possession where he lost the ball and didn't really get a shot. I don't know why he wasn't credited for a turnover. Maybe it was deemed like a blocked shot or something, but he had trouble working in the post at times and just never really seemed comfortable in that game and was just 4 of 13 from the field. Didn't finish well at all. And yeah, you're right. Samaje was a decent, not as great as we've seen. And he didn't take advantage of a couple opportunities when he could have kept Xavier in this game, in my opinion, which is really what they needed. D. Davis didn't provide any offense, was just 1 for 5. Miles Davis was 2 for 8 from 3.
That'll be a through theme for those of you who chart where we go on this show. D. Davis doing nothing offensively is a that's not the last time you'll hear those words. Go on, Rick. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're fine. I think the Musketeers weren't terrible offensively in this game, but to make up for the way they played defense, they needed more out of some of these secondary guys. I mean, you know, Kristen still put up his points. Martin had a really good game, 9 of 15 from the field, 19.7 boards, 2 assists. I mean, he was hitting fadeaways off the bounce. He was really good. Stainbrook, again, 11 points isn't terrible. You'll take it. You had enough scoring in this game to be in it, but the defense was just awful. I mean, they let Providence shoot 64% from the half in the second. I'm sorry, 64% from the field in the second half when they pulled away. And you're right, Dan. It was like every time, you know, Xavier had it within a couple possessions to where they could maybe make a run and get back in it, Providence kept nailing big shots and just kept their lead intact and never really gave Xavier a realistic shot of making a comeback in the second half. And that was kind of the name of this game. The offense wasn't good. It wasn't terrible. The defense was, especially in the second half, as bad as it's been all year.
Yeah, and I think when X sort of had those futile attempts to come back against Creighton, we were able to say, well, the reason this is happening is because Creighton has a historically good offense. But now it's happened 3 times that X has gotten into the second half on the road, been down, been able to keep it within a possession or two for 2 or 3 minutes at a time, but gone through periods of time where they can't get a stop to save their lives. And I want to talk about this may be jumping ahead, Rick, but I want to talk a little bit about the 3-point shot, because I think that Xavier is getting killed because they do not hit the 3-point shot with enough frequency and because they do not defend the perimeter at all. So let's talk about some of the numbers. These are ugly, but let's talk about them. You look at X, you look at in conference play, X is allowing their opponents to shoot 41.8% from the three. That's by far the best percentage in the Big East, in Big East play so far this year. But just as interestingly, or perhaps depressingly, the teams that Xavier's playing are scoring 35% of their points from the 3-point line, which is also the highest percentage out of any set of opponents in Big East play. And we're now through 9 games. Everybody has played each other. We've gone through one full round robin here. So there's no strength of schedule to equalize or anything like that. The Musketeers have just been getting scorched from the perimeter. When you look at it from the offensive side of the ball, the Muskies don't actually shoot a bad percentage from three point range. They're at 34% in league play. I believe they're a little bit better than that. Let me check. I'm sorry. Yeah, 36% for the season for all games. But the problem is they just barely shoot threes at all. Only 27.7% of their 3-point attempts are 3-pointers. That's second last in the Big East. Meanwhile, opposition, 36% of their shots are threes, which is the second highest percentage. So in other words, Xavier opponents are taking threes at a very high rate, and they're making them at an almost unbelievable rate. Meanwhile, the Musketeers are barely shooting any threes at all, and they're not hitting a whole lot of them when they take them. So what you're seeing on a game-to-game basis, so we look at this Providence game. Musketeers 3 of 18 from three. Now, granted, that's one of their worst showings of the year. 3 of 18 from three. Meanwhile, Providence is 8 of 20 for 40%. That's 15 points you give up on threes right there. Xavier shot a better percentage than Providence on twos. They hit 7 more twos than Providence did, and yet they still found themselves. And yet they give up 15 points from the 3-point line, and they give up way too many foul shots. So that was one example of that. If you skip ahead, you look at the Seton Hall game. There again, Musketeers 8 of 22, which actually isn't a terrible – or I'm sorry, they were 2 for 14 against Seton Hall from the 3. Seton Hall shoots 8 of 22, including hitting a bunch of big shots in the second half. Villanova, you know, they shoot 11 of 28, 39%. Musketeers actually didn't shoot badly from the 3-point – from the 3-point line, but they got absolutely buried in the second half by guys like James Bell and Darren Hilliard and Javon Pinkston early in the game. So this 3-point shooting issue, I mean, we've talked, so now you know what the problem is and what the scope of the problem is. Can you diagnose what the problem is for the Musketeers as far as their inability to defend the perimeter in Big East play?
It's hard to diagnose because, one, it's something different in each game. I thought that in some of the games it's been a lot easier to see. Like in the Georgetown game, it was dribble handoffs. In Creighton, it was bad communication in transition, pick and pops, just the bigs completely being stretched out the entire game and them playing all five guys out. In this Providence game, it was a little bit of everything. You had bad communication in transition. You had guys picking and popping. What it all amounts to is that they're slow. For one, I mean, you have both Fillmore and Stainbrook on the court who are moving slow, and a couple other guys who just seem to be a step behind right now. And I don't know if it's mental or physical. I mean, I guess it's probably different for each one. In Miles Davis, you know, it's probably more of a physical thing. And in J-Mart or Brandon Randolph's case, if they're out of position, it's probably more of a mental thing. But that's a huge issue, is just the lack of speed. But the other part is, I mean, you've just got to be better. I mean, there's got to be more energy off the ball. You can't be a step behind. You can't be trailing your man on a cut. You can't fall asleep for that second. You've got to jump to the ball when it's passed one pass away and be in that gap. You can't be a step late.
I think, Rick, that when you look at just we'll come back to the offensive issues with the three, because I think there are more things that we want to talk about. But when you look at this Providence game, I mean, taken in isolation, this is not a bad loss. Providence, pretty good team. They've done really well at defending their home court, including a blowout victory over Creighton relatively recently, I think a week before the Xavier game. And Providence, a top 50 team in the KenPom rankings. They're probably right now a sort of a bubble level NCAA tournament team. But my expectation would be, with the talent they have, that they will end up making the NCAA tournament. So in isolation, this is not that bad of a loss. If Xavier had lost this game, beaten Seton Hall, and then played Villanova relatively tough, I don't think we'd be talking about this, and we would be, you know, picking out, nitpicking little things from the stat sheet and from the run of play that give us bigger concerns. But the problem is they turned around, they laid an egg against Seton Hall. And the first thing I want to talk about when we talk about the Seton Hall game is that this is the latest in a series of games where Xavier has just not been ready to play from tip. They were down 8-0. Two of those baskets were scored on pick six turnovers, which Chris Mack always harps on as things that they cannot do. And it was evident from jump that Xavier had no idea what to do with the matchup zone that Kevin Willard put out there to start the game. So, I mean, what do you attribute these slow starts to? Because we saw it against Seton Hall, St. John's. We then saw it in the Villanova game. You know, we've seen it earlier in the season, whether it be Bowling Green, Evansville, et cetera. What do you attribute Xavier's frailties, you know, from jump in these games?
If I had the answer, if the coaching staff had the answer to that, they wouldn't be losing. I mean, that's as simple as it gets. No one knows. There's no reason to not come out ready to play. That's on the players. That's something they have to figure out themselves. I think the biggest, well, we can just go. We've got the audio pulled up right here. We can go to Mac for this. I think the biggest thing for him was the mental edge or lack thereof that his team came in with.
What do you want to see different Monday night approach compared to today?
Well, when you play a top 10 or whatever they are team in the country on their court, you better be ready to play. And again, I think no disrespect to Seton Hall, but the first 3 or 4 minutes, I didn't feel like our team was ready to play. When Fuquan Edwin is coming off stagger screens and it's almost like we have no idea that he's coming off stagger screens, getting 3-point shots early in the game. When we go for shot fakes on Alda, who shot fakes every time he touches the ball, and it was talked about, then that attention to detail, that readiness to play, wasn't where it needed to be. It better be there on Monday night, because if it's not, we're gonna be in trouble.
Well, that proved to be prophetic, because it wasn't there on Monday night either. But sticking with this Seton Hall game, I mean, I thought that was the biggest thing. It's where is this coming from? How do you solve this problem? They sit there on Thursday in the walkthrough, and one of the actions they talk about is that exact Fuquan Edwin pin down that Mac was talking about. And then it's like the first time they run it, this is not a thing that Xavier usually struggles with. Okay, these are their wings fighting around a staggered screen. They have the mechanisms within their defense. They have things in place to defend these types of situations, and they work on them. And they talked about it coming into the game. And for them to give up those open shots, that's the problem. I mean, if guys are going to make tough shots or are going to beat you once in a while with a really well-designed play or something that you don't know they're going to do coming in, a guy's hot, or you have to adjust your game plan because the guy's doing something that the scouting report didn't say, that's one thing. But when they're getting beat early in the game by shooters coming off staggered screens and hitting shots that they knew the exact action of, that's on the players to a certain extent. You've got to play better. They can defend this. We've seen them defend these things before. So I know a lot of people are wanting to pin this on the players aren't good enough, and they need to do a different defense or they need to completely change the schematics. That's not necessarily the case. These guys have defended a lot of these situations before, and they're not right now, especially when you talk about things like the slow start in the Seton Hall game. That was on the players. They didn't come ready to play.
The disappointing thing about this was that X had lost that Providence game, and they had a full week of practice to prepare for this game.
I fully believe that's overrated. I mean, we talk about it, and I'm still going to mention it. Like, if I write something, I'm going to say, look, they had a week to prepare or work on this or that. And I thought it was important for them to have a week of practice. I think Mac and the coaching staff was glad they had a week of practice to try to get the defense right. But I'm still a big believer in the week layoff. More often than not, in my opinion, and maybe it's just in my head, but it seems this way with a lot of teams, leads to a slow start in the first half of that next game. I don't know if you've noticed that, but that's what I seem to think, that week layoff is way overrated by the media.
Well, I'm just thinking back to when we've seen X have those layoffs before this year, and they started really well against UC. They started well enough against Alabama. I mean, they've had these layoffs before, and they haven't come out as flat. The other disappointing thing was that they were returning home. I mean, this was a home game. They're still sitting at that point 5-2 in the league. It was a very mediocre atmosphere at Cintas Center. But honestly, when the team's behind 8-0 and the other team is basically running a burn offense, and X doesn't really have any clue how to attack the opposing team's defense. I mean, I sort of understood why the fans were lethargic, especially in the first half. Now, X did make a nice run toward the end of the first half to overhaul the deficit at the beginning and get it to 28-27 at half. And I actually thought that might be what pushed them forward. I thought that might have been that little run they had before halftime might have been what they needed to get the momentum back. Because if you remember the last, I think, play of the first half, there was a deflection, and Seton Hall ends up with a great bounce. They have a 2-on-1 with James Farr in space down at the other end. And Farr does just an amazing job I don't know if he blocked either shot, but he affected both shots and then eventually got the rebound and kept the lead for Xavier going into halftime. And I thought at that point, you know what, Musketeers, they're going to come out of the half just like the St. John's game, and they're going to really do a nice job and win this game. And it looked like they were going to do it. The first possession of the second half, they worked the ball into Stainbrook. He scores. They have a 3-point lead, and immediately they lose a guy for a 3-point shot at the other end. And that was just the story for the entire second half. Xavier would huff and puff and huff and puff and get a little bit of an advantage, and then immediately lose a man on a pick and pop or just completely fail to fight through a screen or whatever else. And Seton Hall gets a good look, and they get an and one, or they hit an open three. And the second half of that game, it just was, it was dire in a lot of ways, because the Musketeers could not get a stop to save their lives. And that's been the story, unfortunately, in too many of these games recently.
Yeah, well, they gave up 60 points, which, I mean, not terrible. It was a little bit slower paced game than they've been playing. But Seton Hall averaged 1.07 points per possession, which isn't great, obviously. And you're right, X couldn't get the stop when it mattered. Threes were a problem. It was a lot of transition threes, and then guys just not getting out quick enough or closing out hard enough on shooters. I know Fuquan Edwin and Brandon Mobley both killed X. And Edwin is a guy that they knew coming in. Mobley wasn't really that much of a threat. But again, we've seen this so often. It has to be in the scouting report of other teams at this point that if you have a face-up forward that can shoot at all, get him in position to take shots, because Xavier's letting these guys step right into them. And someone was saying it on Twitter that it's like, you know, it's shooting practice. You're 1-2 stepping into a wide open shot. Most college players are going to be able to make that. And he's right. I mean, you know, Brandon Mobley wasn't expected to hit three threes. That wasn't in the scouting report. But when you give him three wide open threes that he's able to 1-2 step into, he's going to knock them down.
Yeah, I mean, Ken Pomeroy did a study a long time ago, a couple years ago, I think, where he was studying 3-point shooting and trying to determine, I guess his hypothesis was, whether or not how much control the defense has over what the opponent shoots from three. And he discovered that with rare exceptions, teams are generally going to shoot what they're going to shoot from three, regardless what the defense is. But there are some outliers on both ends. It's similar, I guess, in spirit to the baseball thing, the defense independent pitching statistics. But I mean, this Xavier team defends the perimeter so poorly that they actually inflate the other team's shooting percentage because they get so many good looks. You know, and the problem in this Seton Hall game is, yeah, Seton Hall only scored 68 points. That's good. Usually Xavier, you know, with as good as their offense has generally been this year, 68, they'll usually win. But when you're giving up 24 points from the 3-point line, even though Seton Hall only shot 36%, those points become bigger and bigger because there are less scoring opportunities in the game. And meanwhile, the Musketeers are 2-14 from the 3-point arc. D. Davis just had a nightmare. That's really all you can say. He played 35 minutes, 1-6 from the floor, 5 turnovers. I mean, just really scuffling out there. He did have 5 assists, which is good, but you know, that line may not look as bad if anybody else on the team could hit a jump shot. But Miles Davis was 2 of 7. James Farr missed his only attempt. Justin Martin missed both of his 3-point attempts. And then, you know, they compound the problem by giving away 12 points at the foul line, 12 plus points, we should say, because I don't have the play by play in front of me, but I'm sure there were some front ends in there. And it wasn't, you know, something that was constrained to only one player. Everybody was missing foul shots. Stenger 0 for 2, Farr 0 for 2, Miles Davis missed one, Martin missed one, Samaje 5 for 9, which is probably the worst foul shooting performance he's had in a month. There were just so many breakdowns in this game from a Xavier perspective. And, you know, the other thing about it was, is it just didn't seem like they had anything in the tank at the end of the game. I know they got it to 65-60 and got the ball back and had a turnover, but the last 10 minutes, they just did not seem to have enough energy. And I think the scoreboard shows it. Seton Hall outscored X 23-14 in the last 10 minutes of the game. Just a very disappointing result.
And that's been a common theme. This is the poorest effort they've put forth at the Cintas Center in a long time. I mean, I'm trying to think. Do you have any games that come? It's got to be going back to last year. I mean, they haven't played that poorly on their home court this season. I'm trying to think.
I think they were pretty much garbage against Bowling Green. I mean, I thought they had a terrible game against Bowling Green. That's a 200 plus KenPom team. But if you do want to look back to last year, I mean, losing to Vandy at home was disappointing. They blew a 13 point lead in the second half of that game. The Wofford game was a complete disaster, but in some ways that was because of a bonehead play. They should have been in overtime in that game. And then in league play, I think they only lost what two home games, and they were to VCU and UMass. Both of them were pretty good teams. Yeah, so I actually think you would have to go back probably to that Vanderbilt game last year. And then before that to the Oral Roberts game.
Oral Roberts
without their entire team 2 years ago.
That Oral Roberts game is definitely ranks up there with all time. You know,
yeah, but Andre Walker was playing point guard the starting point guard in that game. That's so it's a little point. Bit difficult to kill them too much for that when you're playing three starters down against an Oral Roberts team that year that was a top 100 team.
That's a fair point. Well, getting back to the Seton Hall game, I mean, you mentioned on the biggest takeaway for me was what happened to the offense. I mean, we had maybe seen some signs of it in that Providence game. I mean, mainly the fact that they just couldn't hit the big shot when they needed it. But in this Seton Hall game, they just flat out couldn't hit any open shots. And Seton Hall stayed in that zone the whole game. You know, Xavier, both teams made 21 field goals, 8 for 22, but X just went 2 for 14 against that zone. And it was kind of interesting, I thought, what Kevin Willard had to say after the game about basically why they decided to stay in the zone that whole game, because they haven't been typically doing that. They've been playing a lot more man-to-man and mixing in the zone, but they stuck with it pretty much the whole time.
Your ability to hold them from three-point range, that seemed to be a big difference in the game, especially down the stretch.
Yeah, I mean, that was with such short preparation, which we're getting a lot this lately, is I just didn't think we could defend them man-to-man with not having enough time, with only really one practice to prepare for them. They run so much good action, not only for Samaj, but, you know, really for Stainbrook. So we decided if they're going to beat us, they're going to have to make shots from the outside. So we just zoned them. I thought we got a little lucky in the second half a little bit. I thought they got some open looks, but, you know, sometimes that just happens.
And there you go. It sums it up perfectly. I thought what we're seeing here to an extent, and I know everyone wants it to be instantaneous. Okay, well, make adjustments. What are you? Can't you coach? Well, you don't not see you're not scoring. Change it up. Well, it's a little bit more difficult than just saying that. You need to run through some things. You maybe need to install some things. But this team earlier in the year wasn't scoring like this. We talked about how thin of a margin they had for error on the offensive end if Samaje or Stainbrook didn't play well. Then all of a sudden they started scoring the ball really well, and it was because of what Willard talked about. They're running all these offensive sets really well. They're running through the ball screen motion and getting a lot out of it because Stainbrook could do so many things, whether he's catching out of the high post or passing out of the low post or scoring himself. Samaje has been unstoppable. Martin's been knocking down shots. D. Davis has been knocking down shots here and there. They were a different team when all that was happening. Now you go back to this. Well, guess what? Teams are going to start trying to take that away. And now that some teams have seen, well, guess what? They don't shoot all that well if James Farr and D. Davis and Miles Davis aren't hitting at the same time. They're not a very good shooting team. So you zone them. Or if you're like Villanova, which we're going to talk about here in a second, and you've got the personnel that's versatile and athletic enough to switch screens, you can switch screens, which really gives their ball screen motion trouble. And that's what you saw Villanova do. So Xavier's going to have to adjust. And I think, like Willard said, they did adjust in the second half and got some great looks, but guys got to knock them down. If you don't make shots, there's not a lot the coaching staff can do.
Well, the big takeaway from this Seton Hall game for me is that what the Xavier team has, and we've talked about this all year long, and it's one of those things that I think is just evident. You heard Willard say it. X has got two guys that you know what you're going to get every night. You know they're going to be productive, Kristen and Stainbrook. And then somebody else has got to step up, and preferably two guys. And we've seen games this year where D. Davis has been flawless at point. Even if he wasn't scoring a lot of points, he's pulling all the strings correctly. You think about the Butler game in the second half where his defense and his floor generalship helped the Muskies overhaul the deficit. You think about the Georgetown game where he was very effective offensively. And you look at this game against Seton Hall, D. Davis, 3 points in 35 minutes and five turnovers. Justin Martin, 5 points in 22 minutes, not being able to knock down outside shots and not really even making an impact on the boards. Meanwhile, Seton Hall's wings, very effective. Isaiah Fillmore in foul trouble, although he was effective offensively when he was in, he's limited to 16 minutes because of foul trouble. And then the bench guys were just absolutely abysmal. Miles Davis, 2 of 9 from the field, getting absolutely annihilated defensively. Farr couldn't really make an impact. Stenger had 4 fouls in 13 minutes. Brandon Randolph did nothing really of significance. And Farr was, you know, kind of a passenger out there. Although, as I said, he had the one really nice defensive play at the end of the first half. So, I mean, this isn't a team that can just get nothing from its bench and nothing from its non-Kristen and Stainbrook starters and win. They're not going to beat anybody if it's two guys against a Big East team.
And let's be honest, a big killer in this game was Justin Martin not showing up. I mean, he played really poorly, didn't score, turned the ball over, didn't quite look like he was with it, and they lose by 8 points, get basically nothing out of him. And, you know, a lot of people are crushing him on the message board and said he's back to being the old Justin Martin, but we see him turn it right back around in that Villanova game and play well again. So I don't know what happened in that Seton Hall game, but looking back on that, if he has another nice output, they probably win that game. I mean, they were in it enough, but they had no help and nobody that could knock down an open shot in that second half. And obviously without Justin Martin being able to do that, it hurt them. They've come to rely on his ability to score.
You can't be one dimensional and you can't be predictable, I guess is maybe the better statement, because if you don't have a tertiary option, if you don't have guys that can make open threes on Samaje's drives, it allows the other team to do exactly what the Seton Hall coaching staff did and collapse and clog the lane and make it more and more difficult for the guys that are productive to do what they do best, because there's no reason to account for those others. Meanwhile, you look at what Seton Hall did and you look at the production they got off their bench. Jaren Cena, 12 points.
Knockdown outside shots.
11 points.
Knockdown outside shots.
Those two guys combined 5 of 9 on threes from their bench. I mean, and then you've got a guy like, you know, I know that Sterling Gibbs is a starter for them, but he's not typically a big scoring option, but he knocked down a couple jump shots, got to the rim. You know, it just was very disappointing. And part of the problem that I saw is that I thought that in the first half, X panicked against the matchup zone to a certain extent. And I remember one play vividly where D. Davis dribbles the ball across the timeline, sees the trap coming, calls a timeout. X goes back. They inbound the ball, and Davis drives into the same trap like 5 seconds later. And it's just like, you know, it just didn't seem like they were prepared to play. And as a byproduct of that, they end up going back to the security blanket, which is run the offense through Stainbrook or have Kristen drive into three guys. And you know what? What's Stainbrook's best attribute? His distribution. And if nobody's knocking down jump shots, then that all of a sudden becomes a little bit less effective. And all of a sudden, you know, Stainbrook, who's a good finisher, but he's not, doesn't have a whole lot of lift. He's susceptible to having his shot blocked, and he's susceptible to double teams. And if you have nobody that the other team has to account for to knock down jump shots, then they can just bring the double team pell mell at Stainbrook and force him into bad decisions. So let's talk about the Villanova game. There's not really, I mean, to me, this one is, you know, this was just a situation where Xavier was completely outclassed, I think, by a very elite team. I thought X was extraordinarily fortunate. After they start off the game, giving up 9 points in a row, they had like 7 points 11 minutes into the game. I thought they were extremely fortunate to go into halftime just trailing by six. Villanova missed a bunch of point blank shots. And then in the second half, Justin Martin, who had to miss most of the first half, hits those two threes in a row. It goes to 31-28. All of a sudden, the Musketeers, for the first time in the game, seem to have a little bit of momentum with about 17 minutes left. And they proceed to give up 50 points the rest of the way and lose by 23. So,
well, it goes back to what you were talking about with the end of games and late in those second halves. And I mean, you have to start to wonder Stainbrook's been playing more than about 30 minutes, it seems like, every game recently. And when he was coming in, we knew he was out of shape. He worked hard to get himself back in shape, but we even still thought, 15, 20 minutes maybe. Is he possibly playing too much? Can he not handle it? Is he not in as good a shape as we thought? He's not the only problem. So I don't know what the answer is, but why they're caving at the end of the second halves and giving up so many points, it can't be just a coincidence at this point. There has to be some type of fatigue or whether it's mental or physical, something's going wrong late in games.
Villanova, as I said, number six AP, I believe, this week. They're an elite team, and they have a fantastic roster. They have great players up and down. When a guy of Chris Jenkins' caliber is the third guy off the bench, you know you're facing a team that's got some real talent. Archie Diacono is a great player. Bell just went completely off against the Musketeers. Hilliard's a good player. Chefu, Pinks, and then, of course, Pinkston, who I believe was all first team Big East in the preseason. Meanwhile, from the Xavier perspective, again, this was two guys carrying the entire load for the first 24 minutes of the game. D. Davis had 2 points. He had three turnovers. Justin Martin gets three offensive fouls in the game, which limit him to almost no time in the first half. Second half, he had that nice burst where he got all 13 of his points, but he was basically a non-factor in the first half. Again, Miles Davis was very poor. Brandon Randolph couldn't make any impact on the game. So, and Fillmore was really had a terrible game. So again, you've got this issue of two guys that basically are providing all your offense. And to a certain extent, the first half went as well for Xavier as it could have, given how poorly they played, and they still got boat raced coming home. So it just was offensively it was bad. Defensively it was worse.
Well, let's talk about Miles Davis. You mentioned his play. Obviously he struggled to get in this one. He's been struggling big time recently. He's been a hot topic of conversation on the message board the past 24 hours. Where do you come out on it on his play at this point?
I think he looks a step slow. I think it probably has to do with the knee injury he suffered right before the season started. I don't know if he's got it's tough for me to say, oh, it's a conditioning issue. I know that's been an issue for him in the past, but I remember watching Brad Redford when he came back from his ACL injury, and there was nobody probably that worked harder in terms of their conditioning. I mean, Brad told us about his gym routine. It was ridiculous.
Right.
And there was nobody that worked harder than him. But when he came back his junior year, he was two steps slow. And so when I look at Miles, I see a guy who does not have elite lateral quickness to begin with and is being hampered a little bit with this knee injury. And it's causing him to be really a liability defensively. And then, as you've said, he's shooting about 20% from three over the last 6 weeks or so. So not a whole lot going right for him. And you know, on the flip side of that, you have Brandon Randolph, who hasn't been getting as many opportunities, I don't think, recently, because D had been playing so well going into this stretch. And he just looks rusty. Doesn't look like he's got he doesn't look like he's totally plugged into the game mentally right now. It looks like his confidence isn't where it needs to be. And so as a result, X isn't really getting anything from its backup guards. And when D Davis struggles, one of those guys has to step up and produce. And it just hasn't happened.
I completely agree with you on Brandon Randolph, first of all, and what you said about his confidence. I think, so, you know, he never really got into a great flow this season. He was playing a little bit better when he was getting a lot of minutes early in the year. But more than anything, he was just getting more opportunities to eventually make a play. Right now in this limited role he's seeing, he's just behind a little bit. He's not quite there. He's not finishing at all. And he makes too many mental mistakes. He's a freshman. And so is Miles. I think, all I'll say, especially on Miles, I think the jury's still out on Brandon a little bit more, is I think people are forgetting what we've already seen out of Miles earlier in this season and some of the things he was able to do offensively. And against more elite competition in the Big East, he's not going to play as big of a role, and maybe he doesn't play as many minutes going forward when you have more talent on your roster. But I'd be very quick to rush to judgment on him in his freshman year. I think this is a kid that's going to have a really strong college career, and he is a guy who is an elite shooter. I promise you, you know, the thing on the message board now that he's not shooting well is that he really isn't a great shooter. And obviously the same thing was said about Justin Martin. I promise you, Miles Davis, they don't come much better in the nation as shooters than Miles Davis. In that class, there were not many kids at all that you would take in a 3-point shooting contest over Miles Davis. So he can shoot the ball. He's hit a freshman wall or is in some type of slump. It happens to shooters, especially freshmen. I think he's going to be all right, but it might not be this year. He might need some time.
Well, I want to talk a little bit because I think Miles contributes, you know, it's not necessarily his fault, but he contributes to this problem that the offense has with not utilizing the 3-point shot. And I was looking at some of the historical statistics for Xavier as we got ready to start this podcast. And one of the things that's stunning to me as I look at Xavier's history is how really not shooting the three has been kind of a hallmark of Chris Mack's tenure with Xavier. Yeah. Other than his first year, when they had Jordan Crawford and Brad Redford on the team, you've seen them rank very low in Division I in terms of the percentage of their attempts at their threes. They were 224th in 2011, and then the last 2 years and this year, sub 300, which is the bottom, I don't know, 15%. And I just don't think that you can have I think when you can't shoot the three or when you're unable to use that weapon effectively, it eliminates so much of your margin for error. Because as we've talked about before, how many times do you see a team, you know, hit a couple threes and keep themselves in touch, even though they're not playing very well? It happens so many times. I think about the St. Joe's game X played last year, both of them. Really, both games, Xavier was in dogfights with the St. Joe's Hawks, and then all of a sudden, whoever their 1-point guard, Galloway or whatever his name is, hits a couple long threes, and all of a sudden it goes from being a tie game, a 1-point game, to an 8-point game, and basically the game's over. So I think this is an issue. Hopefully they've addressed it now with the moves they've made in recruiting. And I know a lot of it has to do with personnel, and I understand that, but it just strikes me that when you look at where these rankings are the last few years, it really erodes your margin for error as an offense.
Dan, you're absolutely right, but it's strictly personnel. It's all personnel. Like, he would love to shoot more threes, and as you mentioned, when there was Jordan Crawford on the team, Jordan Crawford was given the greenest of green lights from beyond the arc. I mean, Brad Redford was allowed to shoot from wherever he wanted. Chris Mack has never told anyone not to shoot. He's not even really encouraged it. It's strictly been a matter of they have not had shooters. Justin Martin was a guy who was supposed to be able to shoot the ball. Griffin McKenzie in the 2010 class was supposed to be a stretch big man. Since then, they've recruited Miles Davis, who was supposed to be in last year's freshman class, but then he gets moved back to this year, and he's not quite living up to potential, Rick, and playing great right now. Alexander Vezdnikov was supposed to be in this class.
Right, but let me make this observation, though. The problem has never been, even in these years where X hasn't scored a whole lot of points from three, that they don't shoot a good percentage. They're shooting 36% this year, 35% last year, 35% the year before. They have been in the top, they've been in the top 100, I think something like 8 out of the last 10 years in terms of their percentage. So it's not that the guys can't shoot. It's that they don't get open looks. They don't, they apparently cannot create perimeter shots for these guys. So I don't know that it's an issue of, well, we're not, whether it's a green light issue or anything like that. It's that the offense hasn't been good enough at getting open looks from the perimeter.
Now that, I mean, that's an interesting take on it. I just disagree. I don't think they have good shooters. I think they've taken shots that you've seen them take desperation threes at the end of games when they're trying to get back in, and they've had some guys that have been good at making those shots, and you've seen them take some really wide open threes like Samaje takes when he's dared, or in the past, you know, guys like Two did, or Brad Redford, or whoever else. But it's usually been guys, the one or two guys on the team who can shoot the three. And the reason they can't get a lot of open looks is because there's only one guy at a time that can shoot it. If you don't have guys who can stretch the floor, multiple guys, then it is tough to get one shooter who's not really athletic like Brad Redford open. So, I mean, you have an interesting point, and I'm not completely ruling it out that the ball screen motion offense or some of the other things that they've run, that they haven't been able to get good looks from it. But I do think most of it still goes back to personnel. It'll be really interesting to see over the next few years. And I do think the great Charles Bronson on the message board, which is obviously one of the better screen names on there, mentioned today, brought up a really interesting point with how this team would look with, I mean, obviously does well, as we all know that, but Alexander Vesnikov, another one, a guy who can really stretch the floor with his ability to shoot, and you look what he's doing for Aris right now, and he's averaging a couple three-pointers a game, doing a lot of his damage from the outside and shooting a high percentage. It would definitely help, and it would change this team. So it would really be interesting to see what they would look like with him out there on the court, and like I said, what they'll look like going forward when they bring in a JP McCura and a Trayvon Blewett.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, Rick, let's face facts. You and Snow, you're the professionals. I'm just a dilettante here.
No. You have a legitimate point, though. I mean, I think it will bear itself out in the next couple of years. They've recruited shooters without question. They've made it a priority because the personnel hasn't been in place. Now, will this make the difference? If they're still not being able to shoot the three at all within the next couple of years, you're right. I mean, there's something wrong with the system. I think that's undeniable.
Still, though, you can say all you want about the Musketeer offense against Villanova and how futile it was, but the problem was defensive.
Right.
And they give up in excess of 1.21 points per possession against Villanova. That's the worst number they've given up this year. I went back through some of the historical stat sheets, and to the best of my ability, previous to this, the only time they were worse, the last time they were worse, was a game in 2012, when they lost by 15 at Dayton in January of 2012. Also, the 23-point margin of defeat was the most since a 25-point loss also at Dayton 4 years ago. That'll piss people off even more than they already are. But this game was especially the second half, when it just became basically a layup line, when they weren't taking wide open perimeter threes. I mean, it actually reminded me, it was so disheartening to watch. It cast my mind back to that terrible GW game. I think Sean Miller's first year, that was just sort of one of those watershed moments where it was like, wow, this is Xavier team really getting its butt kicked. This is not something you see very often. And it struck me as crazy because Justin Martin actually made a pretty good point in Shannon Russell's notes today, because he said maybe it's a sense of entitlement this team feels. I don't know. This is a quote. We don't deserve anything. We haven't earned anything. Last I checked, we were predicted to finish seventh or eighth in the Big East. Right now, we're on our way to it. We've just got to get the identity that last year's team had. And that struck me as so extraordinary, because if there's one thing about last year's team, it's that they did have an identity. They weren't very good, but they certainly did have an identity. They scrapped and they fought and they clawed every possession. And although they didn't have enough talent to win a lot of those games, they stayed in and they fought against teams that were far superior to them talent-wise. This year's team is scuffling. And they have scuffled all year long against teams that are not as talented as they are, with the exception of the UC game, which seems – I mean, you referred to it on the last podcast as kind of a surreal result, and I think it's becoming more surreal by the week.
Yeah,
this team has never really they've done such good things, but they've never looked like they're actually playing at the peak of their potential, except maybe in 10-minute stretches here and there. And what we've seen the last three games is just a team that's kind of that has lost its way a little bit. So the Muskies are now, as we said, 5-4 in league play. They play Providence on Saturday. There's not really any reason to go back through Providence's personnel. We talked about it on the last show, but they've got Providence and then Butler this week. It seems to me that this team is in a very precarious position as far as keeping their fingers on a potential at-large bid. And it strikes me that these two games are pretty close to must wins for this team.
Yeah, I mean, as I said on the message board, I didn't expect them to win that game at Villanova. I didn't expect them to win the game at Providence, but the way they've looked over this three-game losing stretch has been really bad, and they've got to turn things around quick. And this is the thing about playing in the Big East. You can go on a three-game losing streak, because you lose one bad game you're not supposed to lose, and it's sandwiched between games against two really good teams on the road, and you're going to lose three games in a row. It happens, and you can overcome it. It's not the end of the world. And you know, the thing you've got to remember is teams like Villanova and Creighton and Providence are going through the same thing. They're going to have a letdown game at some point too. You know, they're going to lose a game at home that they're not supposed to lose as well, because they're playing good team after good team after good team. So it does even itself out in some regard. I mean, we've seen that in the past. If you've been paying attention to UC and the way their fans have been the past several years, they've experienced these ups and downs. They do happen, but it's all about responding. And if you don't, you end up at the bottom of the conference. If you do, you can stay in the hunt for an at-large bid. And that's the exact spot Xavier finds himself in right now. It's just a matter of what happens coming up on Saturday. I mean, Dan, I think after we've talked about these three games, the biggest problems are on the defensive side of the ball, but they've obviously had issues on the offense side of the ball too, although I don't think they're quite as far away on that end. But let's just start on the defense side of the ball and just kind of talk about a couple of these things. Obviously, everybody wants a change. What people want to see is a zone. Well, let's just throw it out there. They want Chris Mack to play more zone. He's obviously against that. He's talked about it multiple times, that he believes in the pack line defense. He likes it because it gives you answers. And for the record, I agree with him. And it's not from a standpoint of, I think Xavier's coaching staff is always right. Coming in, before I ever did anything related to Xavier, when I coached high school basketball and everything, I was the same way. I mean, parents got mad at me for not playing a zone defense. I hate the zone. I hate the message it sends to your kids on the defensive end. I don't like it. Now, that being said, there's some legitimacy to the argument that this Xavier team may be better suited to play a zone. But I think sometimes people don't realize that doesn't mean you throw them in a zone and all of a sudden you're a good defensive team and you're going to win games at a high major college level. If you change defenses as often as the fan base wanted to change defenses and just completely throw away your system because you're not good at it right now, you'd never be a good defensive team. You go through bad stretches. You have to work through them. You have to have that identity, as Justin Martin says, and know this is what we do in every situation. and you drill it into your head and you keep working and you struggle with it and you work harder and hopefully you find whatever energy or whatever you need to come out on the other side. Now, I'm not saying you don't start to mix a zone in or start to work on something else. I'm just saying it's not as easy as snapping your fingers and saying this personnel is better zone personnel. Let's completely change everything we do and we're going to be good at it. You got to start working at it. I think you got to start mixing in. I think it is time to start using a zone. And I guess I'll ask you your thoughts. Where do you come out? Do you think they need to play a zone? Do you agree with me? Am I an idiot, which we already know? What do you think?
I don't think that the personnel that this team has will allow them to be a good defensive team. I think they can be a serviceable defensive team. I think they can be a defensive team that can win games using their offensive firepower. But I just don't think because of the lack of foot speed that they have in a lot of positions that they'll ever be an elite defensive team. Now, to me, the issue is not maybe the system. To me, the issue is I think that the coaches need to consider looking a little bit toward playing a smaller lineup sometimes, because I just think when both Stainbrook and Fillmore are on the floor, it makes Xavier so susceptible to wings stepping out and hitting the three. And we've seen it so many times this year with even like a Javon Pinkston, who's more of an inside player, stepping out, hits three threes in the first half. You've got Fuquan Edwin did the same thing, who can play inside out. I mean, It makes it so easy to attack Xavier when all you really have to do is go inside out and you can instantly get two huge mismatches, because if you've got a big guard, as most of these Big East teams do, and you can post him up on D Davis, there you've got a potential mismatch. And if you've got a four that's got some good quickness and can get away from Fillmore, you've got a guy that can pop a three from the outside. So to me, if I was sitting in the coach's room right now, and I'm sure they've been beating their heads against a wall trying to solve this problem, I would consider trying at least to implement some more lineups where Justin Martin plays the four and where you have Randolph, Davis, and Kristen on the floor, and you try and run a little bit more, because this team is most effective offensively when they run. And I think they need to focus more on forcing turnovers, which they haven't done very well this year. And I think they need to be a little bit more aggressive using a smaller lineup.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't agree with you more. I like both those ideas, and I think those are things that you will actually possibly see them do. I think those are realistic changes. Those are things you can improve on the fly and stay within your system and the things you've been working on, and consider to drill and do the same things you've been doing. But yeah, maybe change the personnel up on the floor a little bit more often and go smaller, because to be honest, you hear about the rough and tumble Big East all the time, but we've seen a lot of teams that play small lineups, or at least a four that plays stretched out. And we know Justin Martin is maybe even better suited to play an undersized four position anyway. So I don't think that's a bad idea at all. In fact, I think, like I said, you may see that going forward a little bit. I just think, again, they need more energy. They have to be quicker off the ball, do their work early. You can't get sealed. James Farr can't get sealed deep in the post. Be in the right spots so you don't have to recover as far. Be in the help position right away. Don't have to help two steps and then run back three to get to your man. Already have the difference cut in half. And their communication has to improve, especially in transition, where they just haven't had that edge. And you know, maybe it's a leadership thing. Maybe when you're relying on guys like Samaje Kristen and Justin Martin, who aren't very vocal guys, and then a guy like Matt Stainbrook, who we've seen really not handle adversity all that well so far this season when things are going poorly, maybe that's part of the issue on the defensive end. They need better communication, better leadership, and guys reminding everyone to play with more energy and play a little faster on that end.
From an offensive perspective, Rick, I don't know that, you know, we talked a little bit about the 3-point issue, and we've kind of thrown that in, but I think I'd like to move. I would kind of like to skip ahead to the question we got on the Skype line earlier today, because I think that kind of gets us to the crux of this issue, and I think it's an interesting question for discussion.
Yeah, that sounds good. So here is our one listener fan question that was phoned in on voicemail.
Rick, this is XU Bob again. Disregard that first call. I got interrupted by another phone call.
XU Bob got interrupted.
Question, you know, again, without knocking the kid. Do you think some of the problem is that we don't have enough true Big East players yet? I mean, I know we got try hard guys and they're working hard, but you know, you look at Fillmore and Stainbrook, they're a step slow. D's a little small. Again, no knock, but will the future recruiting fix some of these ills? Because I don't know if it's lack of execution. I don't think it's lack of effort, but hopefully they can get it fixed and the season will get back on track. Thanks, man. Bye bye.
Well, I think there's a couple parts to that answer, a couple things that need to be addressed in that answer. First of all, I think you've got to start with the talent. Everyone wants to question the talent when things go wrong. And first of all, guys, this team looked fairly talented a couple weeks ago against decent competition. So they're not as bad as they look right now. Okay, they're playing poorly right now, but they're not as bad as they look. They're not great, but they're not as bad as they look. The other thing is, as has been brought up on the message board, if you add in a Des Wells into this mix, things are very different. You know, you've got a couple younger guys and Jalen Reynolds, who's not with the team right now. We'll address that in a second. And Miles Davis, who should have been here last year and maybe already be a year in. And that would probably greatly help things. So there is some stuff there that was kind of out of their control to an extent with the personnel, to where they would be more talented and have plenty of talent to play in the Big East. I don't think they're far off. And to take that a step farther, yes, I do think the recruiting class coming in is going to greatly impact that. I mean, right now they're ranked in the top five in the nation. I've seen most of the guys. Mackinde London, I've only seen play live once. I've seen him on ESPN a couple of times now, but I've only seen him in person once. So it's going to be interesting to see what that class can do right away. I don't know that how good they'll be as freshmen, but I think overall that class will make a big impact on this team as they move forward into the Big East. But I don't think the talent here is terrible right now. I don't think you should be ready to cross guys like Miles Davis off your list and say he's not a Big East talent yet. He's still a freshman guard who is probably playing a little bit more of a role than he should be playing. I mean, you add Remy Abel into this mix next year and that probably cuts into Miles's minutes as well. So again, there's a lot of things at work here to where I don't think they're far off from having Big East talent at all.
I with Fillmore, I think it is unfortunate, but I don't think that we have ever seen the Isaiah Fillmore that the Xavier staff wanted to bring to Xavier because of his injuries, because of the conditioning issues that went along with him. I don't think that this sort of wide body, lead-footed wide body back to the basket game is really the game that he's most comfortable playing. And I don't think that he's ever been able to play the type of game that he played at Towson. So yeah, it's easy to say, oh, well, he was a, you know, he went to a MEAC school. He can't compete at this level. I can't say that for sure because I've never seen him play when he hasn't been operating under these limitations. As far as the talent level, I just think you've got guys that I think you've got guys that have some limitations, but I think that the overall talent level on this team is sufficient to win 11 or 12 Big East games. I just don't think they've executed well enough. I think if they'd have beaten Seton Hall and they were sitting here at 6-3 right now with four more Big East home games to go and with a number of road trips against teams that haven't been particularly strong in Big East play, including St. John's and Butler, Georgetown also, I think that there wouldn't be any question if they'd beaten Seton Hall. People would not be questioning the talent level on the team, I don't think. So to me, what you're seeing is you're seeing some guys underperform in crucial times. I don't think the talent level is poor. I don't think it's an elite Big East talent level. I think if recruiting had come off the way that the staff had hoped it would, they would be at an elite level. But they're not getting Des Wells back.
No.
Alex Vezinkoff isn't, you know, isn't getting his amateur status back. You know, Devontae Smith Rivera is not transferring to Xavier. So
That's a little bit different than the Des Wells situation, though.
Yeah, fair enough. But I'm just trying to lump all these into one big combined.
But when I was making my point before, I'm not talking about guys they didn't land through recruiting. I'm talking about specifically Des Wells, who was on this team and you know, someone who we could have very much expected to be a part of this roster.
Oh, yeah.
You add
him
at the small forward position right now, and then you probably do definitely play J-Mart at the four a little bit more. And this is a completely different team. I mean, no, I don't think anyone can deny that. And you're right. They're probably here's my thing right now, as talented as this team is, even though they've been playing poorly and maybe not playing to this level right now, I think they are the fifth team in the Big East. No, I'm sorry. I think they're the fourth team. I think they're the fourth, right after
after Providence,
Villanova, Creighton, and Providence.
Well, I mean, I think part of it has to do with in preseason, nobody knew that Georgetown was going to be as depleted as they are, and I think people had a completely inflated idea of what Marquette's guys were capable of as compared to the actual style of basketball they're capable of doing.
Definitely.
So I could see, I mean, I see Xavier sitting in the fourth spot right now, and I think they would do well to hold on to that fourth spot. Keep in mind that the top six teams go through directly to the quarterfinal, that and the four lowest seeded teams are the ones that have to play on Wednesday. So for Xavier, I mean, that's sort of the firewall. Is you do not want to fall into one of those Wednesday opening round games. They need to stay in the top six. And I think they have an opportunity to do that, but they've got to get back on track, and it's got to start on Saturday against Providence. Rick, let's talk about Jalen Reynolds' situation briefly and then turn to more congenial topics.
Yep.
If there are any.
Well, news broke on Tuesday that Reynolds was suspended from the team. Ironically, it came right after probably one of his best games when he played 8 minutes against Providence and scored 6 points and grabbed four boards. Coach Mack, I was told that Coach Mack and others had kind of talked about it on Sunday and came to the decision to suspend him indefinitely. We saw the statement from Mack and Xavier's athletic department. Here's what he had to say when media was finally able to meet with him and ask him, one, if Jalen was doing what he needed to do to get back, and two, whether or not he would rejoin the team.
Is Jalen doing what he needs to do now to kind of work his way?
Yeah, he's a couple days in, but that's, there's going to be more time determined to, him make the right decisions all the time and get, a part of this team again and rejoin our team. So it's awfully early into it.
But he could be back this year, you think? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly hopeful that he will be. Yep.
Well, I think there's kind of two things to look at here. One, the impact this has on Jalen and in his career, and two, the impact it has on the team. We'll start with the team. I don't think it's that big of a deal because obviously he hasn't been playing all that much. His minutes are kind of going to Stanger, but I do think that we've seen a couple games where he would have helped. I mean, definitely against Seton Hall, I think we would have seen him play more because there was some foul trouble in that game, and against Villanova, I don't think he really would have made any difference. They were completely outmatched, and certainly his limitations right now on offense weren't going to change that. But for his career, I don't think this is a thing where it's – first of all, I think he's going to be back on the team within likely the next couple weeks if I had to guess. But don't hold me to that because things are still fluid. I don't know the exact situation, what will happen, but I am very confident that it's not a huge deal and he'll be back on the team this season. Let's put it that way. As far as what it means for him going forward, it's not something that's going to impact his future status with the team. It's not going to be a recurring issue. It's something that's taken care of, hopefully by the time he's back on the team and is a complete non-issue going forward. But with regards to his game, he is missing some opportunity. Obviously, he's only going to be playing 5 minutes or so a game, but he is missing practice time still. And maybe now we talk about how the team has been struggling in the last 10 minutes of second half or something. Now the coach doesn't have the option to say, well, maybe what we need to do is get Jalen a few more minutes here and there to rest Stainbrook. You know, that those are the minutes and the opportunities he's missing out on that would better himself. And, it goes from hoping maybe he would have played a little bit more of a role and gotten better as the season progressed to possibly play five meaningful minutes in the postseason a game to he's probably going to be a complete non-factor this year. And you hope he comes back strong in his sophomore year.
Okay. Well, I mean, and I think that the most important thing is that it's not a it's not an issue that is going to lead to Jalen Reynolds being gone from the program. I think people can get that out of their minds. I know there's a tendency when things are going bad on the court to assume things are going bad off the court too. This is going to be a blip as far as
this is I can promise everyone that this is not affecting the rest of the team in the least. Like this, there's not one person thinking about this right now. It is not like a scandal behind the scenes that is bothering the team, and there's no separation of administration and basketball team or anything like that, like we've heard with past issues. It's a complete non-issue to how they're playing right now. That's completely on its own merit with their struggles on the court.
Jalen Reynolds has faced a lot more issues, adversity since arriving at Xavier than this particular issue. So
yeah, he's going to be fine.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. He's going to be fine. That's all I was saying. I mean, it's not fun. No one wants to hear this, but long term, it's not going to be something that we talk about going forward. I mean, it's going to be cleared up and it'll be a non-issue.
Okay. So Rick, non-Xavier topics, anything you wanted to throw out? I know we've run pretty long here today.
We got
to
talk about my guy, the hefty lefty, Jared Lorenzen. Big Jared Lorenzen fan, first of all. I have to say he is truly one of the most special athletes I've ever seen. And I don't know, to God's honest truth, in the NFL that I've seen many stronger arms than he had. To this day, and still there, name a guy in the NFL. I don't know that he has a stronger arm than what Jared Lorenzen had in his prime. He made his return to the football field last night playing for the Northern Kentucky River Monsters, listed at 320. Dan, he's from judging from the pictures and actually I've worked with him a little bit. He's actually sponsored my high school site, and we bought a printer from him when we were first doing production. He's working at ProSource now, and so I've seen him recently. He's well over 350.
If you get online, this went viral a little bit today.
Oh, he broke the internet last night, and I don't mean that as a fat joke. I mean like literally, he was trending all night long.
Yeah, if you get on SB Nation, there was a nice post about it. There was a nice post sort of tracking his post NFL career that was kind of funny, but talking about the various things that he's done. But there's a couple vines that people have posted, you know, little 6 to 10 second videos, and it looks. It's like when you edit your player on Madden and you just make your quarterback just ginormous and he just bounces off people and has like 99 arm strength. It's like watching a video game.
But can still run. Yeah. Oh, he's still like somewhat agile. Legitimately.
And so there is a non-zero chance of a DNV podcast field trip to Bank of Kentucky Center on Sunday. I can just tell you folks that right now.
Do we
now.
Just record a segment of the podcast from there? Is that how we play this?
We may have to go remote. Another thing that we're still working on is we may be, and I don't want to jinx it too much, but we may be on site at the Big East tournament as well, Rick. I don't know that the arrangements have totally been made, but I think tentatively we're hoping to be able to record a couple shows while we're in New York, if it's possible.
Yeah, that would be pretty
figured
sweet.
Figured I'd throw that out there as maybe a little good news for our folks out there here at the end of today's sort of doomcast.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I guess this is unless you have any more entertaining topics to bring up this week, which I don't think there is much. The Super Bowl. What? Any thoughts on the Super Bowl at all? I mean, that was as dominant a performance as I've ever seen in that game.
You tweeted at halftime that. All over the country, fathers are saying, "Hey, kids, get your shoes on. We're leaving in 5 minutes."
Yeah.
That I actually read that just as I was packing up the car seat as we were leaving the Super Bowl party we were at to go home at halftime.
Yeah.
So,
and the thing is, you felt like, okay, he's not going to come back from down 22-0 after half, but it's Peyton Manning. He's going to make it interesting in the third quarter at least, get a couple touchdowns or something. Nope. Nope. Opening kickoff, running back for touchdown. And at that point, everyone just groaned and left. It was done.
Hey, but you know, if there is a positive to it, from a Bengals fan perspective, is when you think about if the Bengals had avoided the injury bug this year, they didn't have as dominant a defense as Seattle, but they had a defense that was in that tier right below Seattle.
Yeah, it's built in the same mold.
Maybe with a couple. Yeah, and maybe with a couple tweaks this offseason, maybe Paul Gunther coming in with, you know, Mike Zimmer did a fantastic job, and I'm not saying this to in any way to denigrate him, but maybe having a different voice, you know, maybe there's an opportunity for the Bengals to have a similarly dominant defense next year if Geno can come back and be the player we know he can be, if Leon Hall can be effective, and if they can keep that really talented defensive line together. So that I thought was interesting because it's been they talked about this on the Slate podcast this week in a really interesting segment about how the trend in the NFL over the last 3 or 4 years is they've been relaxing the rules and so forth to make it easier for offenses, and yet a dominant defense like the a dominant defense or a defense with outstanding individual performers, you know, the Seattle defense has both. Last year you saw Baltimore who just had some really good defensive linemen can advance and can win in the playoffs. You think about the New York Giants with that great defensive line they had both times they beat New England. So
yeah, and the Bengals already, you know, have enough talent offensively.
It gives you a little bit of hope, I guess, going forward. But, you know, the question mark is always going to be with the Bengals, how far can Andy Dalton take you? Because that's just the question mark after this current season.
Yeah, but they Rick, have enough talent offensively. They have enough talent offensively to do it. Their defensive line and linebackers are as good or at least close to as good as Seattle's. The secondary is where I think they need to invest in this draft. And I guess Rick, that's my final thoughts on
Rick,
that.
I'm outside the box idea.
What's that?
Jared Lorenzen quarterbacks the Bengals next year.
I'm completely for it. I say you get Lorenzen, Carlos Hyde, and Gio, and you just run the triple option.
I think
Cole Rain style.
If the hefty lefty returns to the NFL, he needs to wear a 3-digit uniform number.
Or 69. He'll be that guy.
All right. Well, thanks to you all for listening. If you've stuck around this long, I'm sure. Well, I know a couple of our guys that were tweeting at us about this podcast were threatening to skip this week. So, in any event, we will probably talk to you next after the Butler game on Tuesday. Musketeers with a couple big games this week. Providence actually losing at home to St. John's as we speak by the time. So it could be that the Musketeers go into that game on Saturday with an opportunity to jump back into third place. So we certainly will look at that. And I think that's it for us tonight.
All right. For the 43rd Joe Nuxall rookie year jersey edition. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Edition of the Teen and Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.